It's August 22nd, 2013, and this is Point of View on 103.7 FM, St. Catharines. I'm your host, Chandra Ligatvalli. Today's 30-minute program continues our focus on the Brock University President's Task Force. Announced last month, the task force consists of 11 members whom will be responsible with a, quote, end-to-end reassessment of the institution. You can find a complete report from Dr. Jack Lightstone's letter, which announced the task force, at www.brockbug.com. Following the announcement of the task force, Brock University Faculty Association President Dr. Linda Rose Krasner released a letter to the faculty which expressed, quote, serious concerns about the legitimacy of this task force. We had Dr. Linda Rose Krasner on the program last week.
I think the first one has to do with what we see as a question of the legitimacy of the committee itself, and that has two parts. One is that we believe the committee is infringing on Senate's legislative responsibility to do the academic review of programs. And the second part of the legitimacy issue is the structure and composition of the committee itself. I can refer to the Brock Act, which gives Senate the ultimate responsibility to monitor and maintain the quality of academic programming at the university.
That was Dr. Linda Rose Krasner from last week's episode of Point of View. You can find the episode by visiting facebook.com/POVradio. This week, we have the Brock administration in to speak about the task force. In the studio with us today is the second in command of Brock University, the Vice President, Academic, and Provost, Dr. Murray Knudela, who is co-chair of the President's Task Force.
Senate is absolutely sovereign when it comes to matters of academic program planning, new programs, old programs, program changes. Any academic program change of any sort will and must go through Senate. We all get that. I've spent my life defending Senate.
Stay tuned for more from Dr. Knudela after the news headlines. We've asked the BUSU president to come on the program regarding the president's task force, and he had this to say via email, quote, as per the communication plan of this committee, the co-chairs of the committee and Brock's communications department are the chief mechanisms of information dissemination, end quote. In the news, BUSU sources are telling me that bus routes are going to be making significant changes to routes that affect students. Visit BUSU.net for information about bus route changes. In student media, the Brock Press is relaunching its website. The student-funded campus newspaper has a new website at www.brockpress.com. We're told that they're fixing the glitches that come with the new website launch and will be running full speed for September. The majority of Brock Press's funding comes from a $2.70 per credit ancillary fee. We've invited the Brock Press's editor-in-chief to come on next week's program to have a discussion with us about student media and the 2013-14 plans. Editor-in-chief Tim Stacey responded by declining the interview. This means that next week's special focus on student media will, so far, only have Ryan Mocha, the executive director of Brock TV. He'll be in the studio to tell us about the coming year at Brock TV. Brock TV, which is Division 13 of BUSU, runs entirely on a $3 per credit ancillary fee. My agenda as a journalist at Brock includes building bridges with the other student media organizations on campus such that we can collaborate. Brock students spend more than $600,000 per year on student media, and it's my sincere belief that if our diverse organizations pull together, we can set forth a new tradition of student journalism solidarity at Brock. In other developments on the program, the September 5th episode of Point of View will feature a Brock student government and civics lesson. I had asked BUSU government operations manager Josh Doan to come on the program to explain the structure of campus politics. However, I'm told that the BUSU executive has decided that only the elected student reps may speak to the media. Doan is speaker of BUSAC, and his job description is covered in Bylaw 300. The language of this bylaw does not specify a need to speak to media, but it does say that the speaker of BUSAC is a liaison between other groups such that students are informed about their rights to representation. In his stead, we're told that BUSU President Cooper Millard will be on the program to explain to the public the ins and outs of the campus democratic representational system. We're also going to dig deeper into BUSAC's newest bylaw, Bylaw 4200, which is the Referendum Review Committee. We had Vice President of University Affairs Roland Ehrman, who had this to say about Bylaw 4200.
What we've done is within BUSAC, our student council, is we're going to have a referendum review and implementation committee. So hypothetically speaking, say, again, I want to run the Roland Ehrman referendum fee, and it's not structured too well. Well, one, I could probably go to this committee and present my referendum idea, in which I would get a lot of feedback that it's probably not very strong and shouldn't go to the student union to waste individuals' time. But if for some reason I have a really strong backing behind it, you know, and I provide budget lines and exactly what I'm doing with that money and it got approved, well, the referendum review and implementation committee would be there to ensure that the mandate that I've set and that my budget that I've set, you know, I'm meeting those requirements. And I'm constantly being monitored that I'm doing the right thing and I'm doing what students voted for and why they voted yes.
We've also invited the bylaw's author, Vice President of Finance and Administration, Christopher Yent, to join us on this topic, and we look forward to speaking with him about that. As always, you can reach us at facebook.com/POVradio. And email me at povradiobrock@gmail.com. After the short musical break, we will have on the program Dr. Murray Kanutala, who is the co-chair of the President's Task Force and Vice President of the University. So stay tuned for that. Today we're talking about the President's Task Force, as we have been for a few weeks here on the program. We're here in the studio with Dr. Murray Kanutala to talk about the President's Task Force. Dr. Kanutala, please tell us about your job at the university, and let's start about talking about the President's Task Force itself.
Okay, thank you. My position formally at the university is I'm a professor of sociology, is my academic home, but I'm also the vice president academic and the provost. And in the second role, in the second two roles, vice president academic and provost, I have responsibility for the overall academic operation of the university. And from the provost role, it's the, I suppose, if you will, second in command in some ways to the president for the mostly internal affairs of the university. Universities have evolved as of late, and presidents' roles have become increasingly external, dealing with matters external, but I'm internal.
So the President's Task Force has received a bit of attention from the Brock University Faculty Association, the president of which, Dr. Linda Rose Krasnor, wrote a letter which she addressed to the faculty, outlining a variety of concerns that that she, on behalf of the Faculty Association, has raised. And she was on the program last week. One of the points that Dr. Linda Rose Krasnor raises is that, and I suppose that this is evident in the minutes of the Senate, is that it's a Dixon process. Can you explain what is a Dixon review process, and how heavily influenced is this process by Dixon?
If I could, because I'm a sociologist, context is everything. I would make a comment on the situation we're faced at Brock, which is very common, quite frankly, across the Western world and certainly in Canada. And that situation fiscally is one of rising costs. It's one of government policy that's reduced tuition income, that's capped enrollments. And so we are because I come from a rural background in Saskatchewan, in a cost price squeeze. And so a number of universities have undertaken a variety of measures to try to address that cost-price situation. Now, the Dixon piece is interesting because, in fact, Dr. Dixon wrote a book a number of years ago. It's been reissued on the process of instigating program reviews. Now, ever since I arrived at Brock, and indeed over the last 5 or 6 years, Brock has been facing very difficult fiscal circumstances. And so just before I arrived here, a plan was approved by the Board of Trustees to address the growing difference between costs and revenues. That process involved essentially 4 years of across-the-board cuts. So everyone got the same shave. There was a standard reduction. 1 year it was 4.8, 1 year it was 2.8 across academic units. Most academic units, that process is interesting because it's simple. Everyone gets the same haircut, but it's unfair because it doesn't differentiate units that may be continue to be essential to the university's mandate, programs that are expanding, programs that are in decline for a variety of reasons. There's no differentiation. Everyone gets the same haircut. And that process received a considerable amount of criticism. And a number of universities did that. The process that follows Dixon is one that, in the first order, what a university does before it makes budget decisions is it has a good look at all of its activities, everything from snow removal to academic programs. And so typically the process involves the development of first of all, the identification of programs, which is the step we're in right now. What programs do we have? How do you define a program? And so on. The next step involves the establishment of criteria by which, on the basis of which you'll collect data about those programs and academic programs. It might be, you know, student enrollment, student demand, graduation rates, employment rates of students, many, many different measures. In administrative or support areas, it might be how many people are employed? What does the unit do? How does the unit contribute to the university's strategic direction? So the Dixon process is an effort to try to provide pre-budget decision systematic information across universities, because universities in Canada over the last three or four decades have been interesting, mostly, or four decades. In the post-war period, we were lucky. If you built it, they will come. And so universities tended to expand rather haphazardly. We would look for opportunities, and I'm not talking about Brock, I'm talking about universities generally. We'd look for opportunities. Ah, there's a demand for this program, let's start it. Oh, there's a demand for this program, let's start it. And that worked well as long as there was money coming into the system, as long as enrollments were going up, as long as the government was funding the universities appropriately, as long as the revenue generated from a variety of sources was equal to or greater than the costs, that worked well. Well, various fiscal crises of the state over the last 20 years, plus various stock market collapses, have changed that situation across the Western world. And so over the last decade, universities have increasingly, as I say, faced the situation we're facing here at Brock. And they've done a number of, tried to do a number of things. So a long answer to your question, Dixon is a particular, it's a book. He's a guy who has come up with an approach that has been adopted by a number of universities. University of Guelph, for example, really adopted a very, in fact, they had him in, as I understand, as their consultant. And he set up a process by which they would review programs using his criteria. We've had conversations with the folks at Guelph. Other universities have used variations on Dixon. The University of Regina, I know, for example, had a task force in employing a kind of Dixon-esque rationale. What we did is the approach we're adopting is anything from pure Dixon. Dixon is a book that members of the task force have read, but we're adopting some of his some of the logic. So I guess I would argue not everyone who does a task force, I don't think he has a monopoly on those ideas. There are some rational things any rational person would do if you're reviewing programs. You would look at costs, you would look at revenues, you'd look at opportunities, you'd look at demand. And I don't think Dixon has a monopoly on those, and those are the kinds of things we're looking at.
So Dr. Lightstone, in his letter, outlined that belt tightening across the board has taken the institution as far as it can go. Is this task force a novel approach? And is it different from what QP tells me is an effort to find compressible income, such as cutting from non-full-time staff, paper costs, TA costs, and instructor costs? Is this a novel approach for Brock University?
I don't think that adopting the approach of a task force as a pre-budget piece is particularly novel. As I said, a number of universities in Canada are using it. It's been used across the United States. I think the important thing to understand about the task force is it is an opportunity to provide a better flow of information into the budget process, quite frankly. The budget process at Brock, that Brock has operated on is common across universities up to now, and typically referred to as a historical budget model. And the cuts across the board that I spoke to a moment ago operate on a historical budget model. Units have budgets that were established at some point in history. In the good times, those have gone up. In the bad times, those have gone down. But there's no necessary relationship between the budget and the activities of the unit at a given moment in time. So it could very well be hypothetically the situation that there was an area of high demand, high student demand, or an area that was deemed socially important 25 years ago, and a university might have invested faculty and teaching assistant money and so on in that area. For any number of reasons, that world may have changed, and the world indeed will have changed, and the demand for that program is gone, or new technologies have replaced that particular stream of employment. And so what a university would need to do in order to maintain kind of fiscal stability is they would occasionally need to pause and to say, are we doing the right things? Are the programs that are the activities we're doing, are they in line with the strategic direction of the university? Because I think that missing in some of the discourse around the task force is the notion that Brock has had to, for a variety of reasons, develop an integrated strategic plan that lays out an academic direction, that lays out research directions. And the if you build it, they will come era, he didn't have to do that. That changed in the last decade. And so we now have actually an integrated strategic plan approved by Senate, approved by the Board of Trustees, that says this is the direction Brock is going. So now that we have that benchmark, what it's important for us to do is make sure that the activities that we are doing are in line with that strategic direction. Because it may just be that we're doing something in an area that is no longer strategically connected to the strategic direction of the university. And it may be that we have to ask ourselves the tough question, should we be doing that? If indeed our strategic direction is to do this particular activity, and we're spending money doing an activity that's unrelated, is that a prudent use of public resources? Because we are a public institution. We're spending taxpayers' dollars. We're spending the dollars that tuition, your tuition as a student. We're spending your tuition on academic programs, and we need to make sure that those academic programs have, in fact, some connection to where we now know that we're going academically. What a task force does is it looks at all of the programs instead of just cutting everyone. It looks at all of the programs, and remember, the task force is not the budget committee. The task force is providing information. The task force will not make budget decisions. The task force will provide information about strengths and weaknesses of various programs, about whether a program is connected to our strategic direction or not. That's the function of the task force. It will be another source of information that will feed eventually into the budget decision.
So that leads to one of my next questions, which is how binding will this task force findings be?
The task force findings are not binding in any more way than the advice that might come when the budget committee sits down. What it needs to do, quite frankly, is it needs to make its decisions on the basis of as much information as possible. I have been publicly critical of the historical budget allocation process at Brock because I don't think it pays attention to academic direction. I don't think it pays attention to potentially the needs of students. And I think that one of the things that we've been doing, or I shouldn't say I know one of the things we're committed to doing, and the president is committed to doing this, is to provide as much information into the budgetary decision as possible. As we speak, and I guess that may not be literally true, but right now, and in fact, I have a meeting this afternoon with a group of people who are redefining the terms of reference for the Senate Budget Advisory Committee. It has changed its name to Planning and Priorities and Budget Advisory Committee, and it's a committee of Senate that will be providing the kind of input from Senate into the budgetary piece. So that what's going to happen next year is the task force will have concluded its work, drawn some conclusions about the mission importance of some of our programs, the relationship of costs and outcomes to some of our programs. So that'll be one new piece of information that the Budget Advisory Committee has never had before. The new Senate committee will, under its new terms of reference, have a different mandate, presumably to provide a different kind of information, because quite frankly, I don't think the previous Senate committee, its terms of reference were very limited, and it wasn't in a position to provide budget advice. So I think in the difficult era that we're in, we're going to find more kinds of information.
We'll be right back on Point of View with Dr. Murray Kanudala, the Vice President of University and Co-Chair of the President's Task Force. Stay with us.
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women, 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is what will you do? Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada."
Back on Point of View, we're in the midst of a conversation with the Vice President of the University, Dr. Murray Kanudala.
Now, I should go back to a question you asked. Is this task force about finding compressible cuts? In fact, the answer is no. We've been looking for compressible cuts, quite frankly, over the last 4 years, and non-compressible cuts, and except those were typically done at the unit level. When you say to a dean, Brock is highly decentralized, right? Money, there's this sort of mythology, the 13th floor is sitting on money. Well, we're not. The money flows into the budget committee and it flows out to the deans, right? And so each of the deans over the last 5 years has been faced with the circumstance of cuts 4.8%, cut 2.8%, cut 1.5%. And we're happy to leave it up to the deans, because the closer you are to the action, the more you understand where it's possible to make cuts. So that the cutting of compressibles is quite frankly something that has been a part of what we're doing, and quite frankly it's something that we hope to try to get away from, in terms of leaving doing that without, I think, adequate information. We'll have more complete information, I think, going forward.
So you've outlined that Senate has developed an existing strategic plan. And one of the criticisms that Dr. Linda Rose Krasner from BUFA raises is that the task force, at least in their perception at this moment, seems to not fulfill the role of Senate and instead supplements Senate's role. How does the administration respond to that? I mean, I think you've already sort of covered some of those points, but let's sort of go over that once again. Dr. Rose Krasner says that the task force is fundamentally flawed. And of course, you've read the letter that she raised. How does the admin respond to BUFA's criticisms?
Well, I think a couple things I'd say. First of all, the chair of Senate is on the task force. The chair of Senate is a passionate defender of the rights and responsibilities of Senate, first of all. Secondly, every member of the task force, and the majority of the membership are academics, right? Every member of the task force understands that any decisions that will be made based on the analysis provided by the task force must and will go through the normal Senate procedures. Everyone gets that. Senate is absolutely sovereign when it comes to matters of academic program planning, new programs, old programs, program changes, any academic program change of any sort will and must go through Senate. We all get that. I've spent my life defending Senate. The interesting thing about the task force is, though, and there's an emphasis in some of the material that's been put forward about the task force, there's been an emphasis, unfortunately, on the negative, on fear. This is about cuts. Well, in fact, the task force may very well generate an understanding that results in increased investments in some area. This is a program review, and you might say, this program is not only brilliant, it's world class, if I could use a cliche, and we need to invest more in it. So one of the acknowledged objectives of the task force, according to the president, is to give some information to the budget committee about where we should invest more. What programs should be expanded? What programs should be, we're going to have programs. I'm sure that the task force is going to say, this is a brilliant program and it should be expanded. Or this is a program with huge potential and we need to invest more in it. So I think, I'm absolutely convinced that the task force and its members understand its role, understand the role of Senate, understand the role of the board. And it's important for people to continue to understand that universities are bicameral. We have Senate with absolute jurisdiction over academic matters. We've got the Board of Trustees that makes financial decisions. The task force is as you were, kind of dancing with both parties, understanding both parties. So the task force could no more cut a program in Senate than it could say to the board, give us another $200 million, right? We're looking at programs with an eye to financial viability, understanding fully the roles and responsibilities of Senate.
We've been talking with Dr. Murray Knudela, the Vice President of Academic for Brock University and a co-chair for the President's Task Force. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
We're going to end this week's program by taking a look back at an interview we conducted a few weeks ago with the Vice President of External Affairs from the University of Windsor's Student Alliance. I spoke with Mohammed Akbar about the topic of apathy. So here's a clip from that interview, and have a great day.
So maybe we can have a little bit of a discussion on what is apathy? Why does this concept apathy exist? Here at Brock, there's this precept that the vast majority is entirely apathetic, and in your message to me, you indicated that there was sort of the same concept at Windsor, that the students were like, oh, they won't care, so why bother even thinking about it? And then you say that you proved that the students did care and swept out the old guard. So what characterized the old guard, and what characterizes apathy?
I think what characterizes apathy, really, I don't actually believe apathy exists. I think it's a willful disengagement of people. There is no one who's apathetic who just sits back and doesn't want to engage on anything. Everyone cares. Everyone has empathy in them. It's not like there are people without emotion. So everyone cares about something. It's all about engaging them on their issues and finding out what they want. So I think apathy exists because of willful disengagement. If the goal of your organization is to do things for whatever you see fit, obviously you're going to want the least amount of students involved. But I don't know what Brock's culture is or how BUSU, the student union, affects that. But I know for us, our student union didn't engage students in a meaningful way. It was just, you know, you'd receive silence, and then at election time, everybody would come out promising the world, saying, here's what we're going to give you in return for you voting for us, and then go back. And the idea was people would get elected to positions in, for example, the student union and say, well, I was elected, so my opinion is what people voted in, not my ideas, not my, anything other than me. They elected me, and therefore my opinion is what decides, for example, the president. The president would say, well, I got elected, so I'm going to make this decision even though students don't agree with it because they elected me, even though I didn't talk to them about it during the actual election campaign. Those are things that lead to apathy when you don't engage students and make the organization about them. The annual general meeting of an organization should have as many students as possible. We used to have maybe 2 students show up. The first time I organized for an AGM, we had 50. The year after that, we had 75. And this year, we had about 200, which is almost quorum. And maybe we'll see a downturn in that. But it's the idea that even if students aren't engaging with you, it's that you are trying to engage with them in a meaningful way.
It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore.